Well, hello everyone. Welcome to the April 28th, 2020 session of TeamSpeak for OpenHPSDR. My name is Dave, KV0S, and this week I've been working on a few things in the basement, some programming, and had to reorganize a computer that didn't seem to want to upgrade properly, so that took a little bit of time. So that's about it for me this week. I have been working on testing out some GPS and different kinds of I2C boards, so that's about that. There's not a lot of results yet. So next on the list, we have Dave, KD0EAG. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. I've just been working on some code during the last week, mostly, and not a whole lot else. So I'm mostly here just to listen.
Okay. Next on the list, we have Dave, N1HAC. Go ahead, Dave.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Okay, good. I just popped in, so I'm not sure where you are on things, but I'm eagerly awaiting the magnetometer boards tomorrow or Wednesday. I think they might show up. And I'm looking forward to the Tangerine SDR so that I can do a little bit better on the frequency measuring test. I was a little bit off, but I wasn't really prepared for it, but got my blood running to do better the next time.
Well, fine business, David. And next on the list is Homan, KD2MCR. Go ahead, Homan.
Hi, good evening. This is Homan, KD2MCR. I received a magnetometer board from Dave and trying to understand how to fiddle with it right now. I've been very busy with a lot of schoolwork that is going to end soon. So there's nothing to report at this moment, but I'm still trying to learn how to use the magnetometer and getting to order Raspberry Pi board so I can connect to a system. That's about it for now.
Fine business. And next on the list is Mike, AA8K, shown as recording and Mike muted. And we thank Mike for posting the TeamSpeak sessions to tsarchive.tangerinesdr.com. Next on the list, we have Nathaniel, W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Good evening, Dave. Nice to hear you in the group. Everything's going fine here. Just plugging away. Very busy with school stuff as well, so I'm working on wrapping up for classes there and just trying to keep everything afloat. W2NAF, back to net.
Yeah, I had a PhD exam a week ago, and I have a PhD comprehensive this Friday, on both of which are on Zoom.
That sounds exciting.
And next on the list, we have Tom, N5EG. Go ahead, Tom.
Oh, good evening, Dave. Good evening to everyone in the group. Most of this week has been spent making my computer triple boot rather than double boot. I've got Windows 10, Ubuntu 16, and now Ubuntu 20 on the computer. If it wasn't schizophrenic before, it certainly is now. And it's amazing how many utilities you come to rely on in Linux, and then when you put in a new version, you have to start hunting for them all over again. At any rate, the intention is to update some software to Python, current version of Python 3, and starting with 20 gives kind of a clean platform to do that. Back to the group.
Well, that was what I was doing this weekend, and my big problem was I pulled out my USB stick one step before I was supposed to, so that took a while to straighten out. Next on the list is Scotty, WA2DFI. Go ahead, Scotty.
Well, hello, Dave, and the group, and thanks again, Dave, for running everything as usual. Great job. And hold on one. And this week's been pretty busy. Finished up the non-SDR projects early in the week, so give me some chance to work on some things. The non-SDR project, I'm kind of joking because it's actually a medical device, and the extra test circuits that we added onto the board are actually going to make us able to build a standalone 70-watt HF transceiver. So we'll see how that actually works out. It uses a Max 10. So idea is that we'll take the prototypes, make them all work for our customer, and then we'll add a few parts and monkey around with them and have some SDR boards to play with, as if we don't have enough to do already. So anyway, after that, I really got down to work on the magnetometer version that I think we want to produce. It's actually came to the conclusion that we ought to just forego the PMOD and all that, make it optional, but make it a Raspberry Pi hat, because most of the folks here are going to be using it on Raspberry Pis anyway. So I think we can make it a Raspberry Pi hat. I also added the lightning detector on it, because it turns out the lightning detector is a part that we used a long time ago on some boards that we made at work. And I think I can get a pretty good deal on the parts if they'll continue to give me the price that I got before. And I see Dave is on Vox there. Anyway, we are that's completed now, and I sent it out to a couple people for review. So right now the layout guy is busy doing the non-SDR SDR for a different customer, but when he gets done with that, probably be in about a week and a half, I'm planning to be ready to get him started right away on the Raspberry Pi hat and also on the Tangerine, the data engine, which I'm working on now. Spent the last couple of days on that. So the clocks and I/O and power supply are the only things left to do, and I'm working feverishly on those. So that's about it from down, well, I was going to say down under, but that's Phil's line, right, Dave?
That's correct. So, next on the list, we have Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill. Got a light, but no voice. Still no voice. Well, it looks like Bill will have to straighten that out. So, that brings us to the end of the list, and we're open for general discussion.
Hey, Scotty, quick question. On the Max 10, the 50,000 unit, do you know what kind of ranges of power consumption that thing fits in? I was looking at the data sheet and I couldn't find a min or a max or anything.
Yeah, I don't have that info, and unfortunately the power estimator that Altera or Intel has is not very good. I really got burned on a Cyclone 5 design that I went in and I thought I turned like 50% of the flip-flops, clocking every other clock at like 100 megahertz. I figured this would be a worst case use case, right? And it came up with something like 3 amps of current on the core voltage, 2.5 amps. So I put in a 4-amp regulator, and it worked great until I loaded the part all the way up, and then it drew about 6 amps. So I'm not sure how we're going to get a good current estimate. I'm not convinced that their power estimator works that well.
Okay, so, I mean, in terms of heat sinking, do you have room for a heat sink, and any idea how much power you're going to have to put into that heat sink? User joined your
channel. Yeah, I figure we're going to put a stick-on heat sink on the thing, and hopefully we won't need a fan, but we probably will. It's just a small fan to blow right on it. And so, you know, I'm thinking in terms of power dissipation, it can't be more than a couple of watts, because the ADC dissipates almost a watt. It's smaller, but it gets a lot hotter than the FPGA does in our IQ2. So, you know, I want to guess around a couple of watts. Is that reasonable?
Okay, yeah, I wasn't sure. I was just trying to, you know, see if there was an absolute max on the spec sheet or something. Couldn't even find that.
No, because everything depends on how many flip-flops are toggling at once. And since there's a huge number of them, 50,000 of them, it can vary quite a lot.
Yeah, but you'd think they'd have a spec saying don't dissipate more than X watts or the part will get too hot.
Yeah, that's true. And but, you know, we could look at the thermal dissipation of the package and figure if you add a heatsink on, you're going to reduce that a little bit. I mean, well, you're not going to reduce the thermal to from the die to the package, but you can decrease the thermal resistance from the package to ambient. And then maybe we can figure out with the minuscule airflow, how much power could we actually dissipate and then go backwards from there.
Okay, sounds interesting. I'll have to see if I can find a spec for the package or something. It was just curiosity, so it sounds like you've been there before.
Yeah, and I know you're trying to get a full power estimate, which is a good thing to get, but I'm not being very helpful. Did you get a chance to look at the magnetometer board?
Me? I didn't get anything.
Oh, okay. I could swear I sent it out to you. Sent it out to you and Dave W. and John and Julian.
Okay, let me go take a look.
It's pretty much a rehash of what Dave did. I mean, he did all the hard work.
Okay, yeah, I've got it. Sorry, I thought
user disconnected
you were sending
from
it to someone else. My mistake.
Oh, no problem. It's going to be a couple of weeks probably before we go into layout anyway. But and since it's a pie board, on sheet two of the document there, I put my tentative layout. I don't know if it'll work or not, but it's a goal to work toward. I think it'll easily fit in a hat board, and maybe we can reduce the size of the hat board even. So, Nathaniel, I have a kind of a tentative question I want to get clarification. If we build Raspberry Pi hats with magnetometers on them, how many sets do we need? I'm not sure I can build 20 sets because that's like 40 boards, but is 10 sets going to be enough?
For the starter kit?
Well, it's going to be a Raspberry Pi hat, and then you can take the same hat board and change two jumpers and use it as the remote board, and it'll have the plug-on magnetometer board from what the name of it is. Anyway, it's pretty much the same exact setup that Dave pioneered.
Yeah, I think so. We should probably get together and get on the phone soon or telecon or something and kind of talk about who's going to get these initial pieces of hardware.
Yeah, that's the thing. I don't want to leave anyone out. But we can't really afford to build 100 sets. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
Testing audio.
Let's see. This is where I think we should get on the phone. Maybe later this week or maybe early next week would be better for me because this week's going to be really crazy. And try and figure out what the exact plan is for that.
Okay, we can do that. Thanks. And I think Bill's got his audio working.
Okay, you copy me now?
Sure are.
Okay. Yeah, I spent this week working on the data rate system, updating the simulator and the main control and the user interface, so that the idea is that the main control sends a rate request to the data engine. The data engine comes back with a list of supported data rates, each one assigned with a number. And then the idea is that the user interface will show just the available rates automatically. And then the user can only pick from available rates, the rates that the data engine can actually support. So I've got most of that working. I've got the user interface side working, and I just got the main control part of it working. I just need to put a little bit of glue code so that the list of rates is the one that the user has to pick from. Right now, that part is just from a hard-coded list. But anyway, that's what's remaining. And you might have seen something I put out on the mailing list on that, looking for feedback, adding a command where the SBC can, the local host can inquire to the data engine and get that list back. So there's a little bit of verbiage about that. So back to Ned.
Okay, Bill. Yeah, I commented on that this morning. So hopefully you get that.
Yeah, I'll have a look at it. I worked all afternoon on doing coding. I didn't get back to email very much.
Yeah, I know you had asked what rates do you think we ought to use, and so I gave you some suggestions there. But the ones that you put in, You didn't include the really low rate, like the 10 hertz. Is that inadvertent?
Yeah, I mean, I just threw down there the first thing that came to mind. I mean, just whatever the rates are, that's what it'll select, that whatever the data engine says. So that's all it is. It's just totally flexible. So if 10 hertz is one of the options, it'll work fine.
Well, I kind of think the 10 hertz was needed for the doing the measurements of the Doppler shift measurements.
Yeah, potentially so. Yeah, that's depending upon how we do it. But the jury is still out on how we're going to do that. We had some discussions with Case Western about how to utilize that algorithm that they're using that allows them to do that once per second. But whether we'll be able to do that, as I say, the jury is out on that because it's depending upon FLJG, and FLJG is not able to deal with an IQ file. It wants a WAV file, which means we'd have to kludge up something to output a WAV file, and it would really be a kludge. So we'll figure something out on that, but we shall see.
It seemed like John had mentioned he had some code that would allow him to use the FLDigi algorithm with a IQ file.
Otherwise, I was going to say, could we maybe, I mean, I don't know the structure of a WAV file, but could the FPGA generate a WAV file, or would that be way beyond the scope?
Or is it this sort of thing? Are we running a new radio where you could just put in an IQ file on one end and have it spit out a WAV file on the other?
Well, I'm not sure if I missed part of what Dave was saying because my speakers quit working, but I got this unreliable stuff here. Using a WAV file feels to me like a last resort. We should exhaust every other way of doing it using IQ, because you go to so much trouble to get nice IQ data, and then you got to kludge it up to use just so it can use FLGG. There's another option what I'm talking with John Gibbons about the possibility of taking the routine that is incorporated into FLDigi and not using FLDigi itself, but using the routine that does it, that might be able to work with IQ data. So that's, to me, sort of preferable.
Well, and if there's any kind of pre-processing we could do in the FPGA to have a special FLDigi format output that it could use easier, then we can certainly do that, because we have plenty of formats available. I mean, they're free form, so we could pick a different one.
Yeah, right. Understood.
Is there, okay, a couple of thoughts. Number one, I think the idea of pulling out the frequency algorithm from FLDigi and just having that as a standalone piece of code, or analysis piece of code in the Tangerine SDR is probably, that sounds pretty good, because then it's very lightweight and doesn't take up that many resources. So that would be a plus, right?
Yeah, and then we're not tied to FLDigi revision levels,
which is also nice.
Hey, Bill, have you looked at the that FLDigi code to see how involved it is?
No, I'm basically asking John Gibbons to figure that out. There are so many things to figure out on this that I'm hoping to basically get someone else to figure out all of the details of that algorithm rather than me having to do it, because it's a bit of a learning curve. John Gibbons and some of his students are going to look at it, apparently.
Because I think it'd be a cool challenge to take, put an FPGA package together that would take in IQ data and output whatever the FLDigi outputs. So in other words, move the FLDigi decoding into the FPGA, although it's probably designed to be not very difficult to do, so it will run on low-end computers.
Now, Bill, is there any advantage to getting the Tangerine to interface with FLDigi in general? So, I mean, if we did that, then we could potentially make use of its, multi, its PSK decoder. or the super sweeper, and we might be able to use data off of there. So if we patched in FLDigi, we might be able to access all these other decoders. Is that useful?
Yeah, I think that definitely would be useful. And although I'm there's two ways to do it. One is you could make the FPGA, put the requirement on the FPGA to output a WAV file, or whatever. I'm presuming that's what FLDigi takes in. Or another way to do it would be to maybe extend FLDigi to take standard IQ data format packets, because if the designers did that or someone did that, now all of a sudden FLDigi becomes usable by a whole host of SDRs.
I agree with that. And I've been wanting some way of basically replaying codes into FLDigi and using it to do like analysis. So if I could, you know, take IQ streams and stick it into there, I think, and if you could have it come out, you know, produce the results that are coming out and have them be timestamped and frequency marked appropriately, I think that could be really useful.
Yeah, this is Tom. One consideration, IQ data is double-sided. That means it goes from negative frequency up to positive frequency. A WAV file is a single-sided spectrum. It goes from DC up to some frequency. And so to convert IQ to WAVE, you have to actually go through a single sideband selection process. There are ways to do that, but it'll be one complicating factor in making that conversion.
But Tom, I don't think that's too hard, because that's just an SSBD modulator, right?
Well, it's, for example, a Hilbert transform is one way to build a receiver. It takes a couple of transforms and some adders. There is a method called a Weaver method, which I think is the simplest way to do it. But you're going to end up having to do some kind of complex filtering. Complex not meaning complicated, but complex meaning dealing with positive and negative frequency components. And convert that. So there's a couple different ways you can implement a filter with complex taps, or the Weaver method, which may be the simplest, but you have to do the double-sided to single-sided frequency conversion before you can generate wave samples.
Yeah, yeah. And I built a transmitter that takes IQ data in and produces DAC data out. And I've done that in the FPGA, so I think that's a doable process. That's a similar problem, right? Because I've got IAQ data, and I really only want one half of the spectrum going to the DAC.
Yeah, it's a little bit different problem, but it can be done. And depending on the sample rate, that may be a little bit too much oomph for a Raspberry Pi.
And it would be not too hard for the FPGA, because I'd decimate it down to baseband and then do it at that frequency, and it would be slower.
Yeah, yeah. We can discuss offline the Weaver method, but I did a way back in 2014 at DCC. I walked through that in one of the presentations how to do it.
Okay, that sounds good. Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, the idea of adding another feature to FLDigi to be able to work with IQ data sounds like a lot of promise. That sounds like it would have a lot of promise to me, because first of all, the FLDigi author is open to people adding features and functionality. And the idea that we could use this one thing to all of a sudden now allow the Tangerine to be able to decode if you include all the modes, it's got to be close to 200 different modes that FLDigi can decode. That would add a lot of, I don't know, marketability to the system.
If we could incorporate FLDigi into the system somehow, it certainly would instantly make it more attractive to hams in general, I think.
Yeah, and actually there's an advantage to having it built into FLDigi, because once it gets put in and it tracks all the revisions, then you basically get all of the revision updates for free, because, you know, after version X, where you've added the feature, X plus N is they're all going to work. So you're going to get any new features that they come up with to add just for free.
Yeah, we definitely need to investigate that.
Bill, I would recommend that we let John do that if he has some experience with it.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not volunteering to do that. That might be a little bit above my skill level, but you know, John already has experience with making mods to FLDigi. Now this, if there's very complex work that has to, complicated work that has to be done to take what FLDigi typically works with and make it work with IQ, put it this way, I expect we can probably find the right people to figure out how to do it, even if it's not necessarily me and John, but I'm sure that we can find the right people who we can press into service that would say, yeah, I would love to sit down and make that work.
Is the originator of FLDigi, is he still kind of involved in things, or is he off to the side now, or what's his involvement?
I believe he is still pretty involved. He is shepherding the thing, and he's got some people that work with him on a volunteer basis to come up with new stuff to add, so he's still actively involved and would probably be interested in this. So I will speak with John about this idea and then see where we can go with it.
Yeah, because I would think that would be an interesting way to expand the user base phenomenally overnight. Not that it needs much expansion.
I like the idea.
Well, I'm thinking it would open it up to users of all different kinds of SDRs, not just Tangerine.
I agree with that.
Yeah, it's true, yeah.
But it's easy for me to say, oh yeah, just add that feature when I have no idea how hard it would be.
It's always easy to come up with an idea that somebody else has to implement.
That's right. Those are my favorite ideas.
But working directly with the FLDigi team may be good because, you know, since they know their software so well, that may be a good way. It may be something you want to do.
Well, it certainly gives you an instant out-the-door use case.
I agree. And it's really important to have that for the ham radio community.
Well, so Bill, in your software, if you could interface directly to FLDigi, would that make your job a lot easier with all those FT8 features that you put in?
No, the FT8 feature is trivial because that is there's off-the-shelf code that I'm already using for that. No, what it would do is it would make the one of the major features that we're wanting to implement for ionospheric sounding. It would just make it fall out of the just. It just fall out. It would be right there. In other words, tracking the movement of the strongest frequency within the band. Now, that's just one of the things that needs to be done. I mean, we did have this discussion that with Nathaniel that even if you can track the strongest frequency, there's a lot of other artifacts in there that we want to continue to save for later analysis. But as far as observing the Doppler of WWV, for example, that is one of the primary applications of using FLDigi or something like FLDigi. Some of the other stuff, when you've got all kinds of different the stuff that Steve Serwin looks at, for example, there's all kinds of different reflections and different things going on, and it looks like some stuff may be on long path sometimes because it's so far delayed. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff we'd probably, I guess, use digital RF for and then do post-processing. But for a quick look, just observing the movement of the ionosphere, and the simplest thing to do that, FLDigi or something like FLDigi that does that kind of function probably is one of your leading functionalities for the system. FT8 it's not really part of it. In fact, I'm not aware that FLDigi will decode FT8. If it does, it's news to me. But it doesn't matter because FT8 and Whisper they are their own modes, and there is just, as I say, off-the-shelf software that you can just the Fortran routines, you just call them and you get back a result. It's quite straightforward.
But what FLDigi would give you is it has a super sweeper for things like PSK31 and some of those other modes. So even though you don't have, say, a Whisper and FT8 in there, you would get a PSK.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if people want to use the system to copy other things, oh, it'll, you know, there's Hellschreiber and there's, there's like, if you look at FLDigi, there's hundreds of different options when you include all the different speeds and everything. I think it's even, you'd even copy CW. So, but having it, having something built in for, you just push this button, FLDigi starts working in the Tangerine. That would be a sales point, I can tell you for sure.
And the FLDigi also, I believe, has the software to connect, send the data up to PSK Reporter.
Yes, that gives you a lot of usability then.
Maybe, sure. I haven't really looked at that, but it wouldn't surprise me.
I think so. I'll double check.
So, Nathaniel, I put a link down there to the lightning sensor that I put in the onto the board. I'm curious as to what you think of it, if you've seen it before, maybe.
All right, let me take a look. No, I haven't seen it before. Did you talk to Jerry at all about this?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, if you don't mind, I'd like you to just touch base with him and see what he says, or put it out on the listserv, because last I heard from him, he was wondering if we were including one, because it was on the list from a while ago. And then I said that we weren't, and I think that kind of disappointed him. But, you know, if we can put this back on, he might really be interested in that.
Well, I think I've got to send a note out to the company contact I have that where we bought the parts before. But we ended up buying factory direct parts, and we got them at less than a third cost of what it would cost you to buy in retail or through distribution. And if that's the case, it's not even worth making a version that doesn't have the part on it, because the part's so cheap, you might as well just put it on all of them and not worry about it.
I would really like to support Jerry Krieger. Look carefully at that to make sure you don't need an interrupt. I believe that in order to detect lightning events, you need to have an interrupt, which all of the discussion about I2C has not involved in the past. You could easily put it on your board, but you're likely to need that, I believe.
Well, it does have an interrupt output, and you can set it to a threshold. And you can also, interesting enough, you can set, I think they call, I forget what they call it, the name of it exactly, but it's false triggers. It's a way for you to set some kind of signature for false triggers, and the interrupt will not go active when it detects false triggers if you turn that function on. But what I got out of reading the I2C interface, maybe you can help me out here, and you may know more about it since you've been working with it for the past long time. But it seems to me that if when the register gets set to a certain value, you get the interrupt, but you could still go and read the interrupt register. So what you'd have to do if it was remote is you'd end up having to poll it to look for events. So it's not going to give you instantaneous synchronized time of event, but it will identify events if you poll it often enough.
It's just a question of how fast you want to be polling that bus. You know, all the other I2C stuff so far, I've mostly looked at pulling it once a second. There's also some squirreliness that I haven't been able to find the exact details of about its coexistence on an I2C bus. It might conceive, sometimes it doesn't show up, at least with standard Linux utilities. And for some reason, SparkFun deprecated their I2C capable version of their little board built around this thing, and only sell an SPI version now. There may be some code trick required to make it work reliably, or it is or something else, but I haven't, I've been trying to track it down the last couple of days and I haven't got there yet.
Okay, well, keep going, see if you can find anything, because I'd rather not build any of these things if I have, if I'm going to end up with problems. We're going to build a few to start with, of course, but still, if any problems that become known ahead of time is, as you're well down the road, and then maybe we can think about some way to get the interrupt line back down the I2C port, down the wires. So I have to think about that a little bit.
Something to think, yeah.
I mean, I'd hate to give up a power wire in order to have an extra have the interrupt, but I think it might be possible because the current consumption is so low that I think we could get away with one power wire.
Also, is it necessarily true that you want it on the remote device? Does it make much difference where you're detecting lightning strikes? It could be local, on the local end, and then you'd have no problem using a pin on your Raspberry Pi interface to register the interrupt.
Yeah, because I know they say that you need to, when you put the thing outside, you need to adjust the gain downward to avoid saturation. So it really is designed to work both indoors and outdoors. So you're right, you could use the detection on the input side that's connected to the, where the interrupt is connected directly to the Pi. And then you could use that as a trigger to go read the external one if there was maybe more information available, because the gain is set higher on the outside one, or actually it's set lower, but whatever, it's outside away from interfering carriers.
Gives you room to think about it.
Now, yeah, Scotty.
Yeah, sounds good.
Yeah, go Scotty. Ahead. So with this, the other thing I'd be interested in talking to Jerry about is, you know, what scientific usability do we think this lightning detector has? Like, how sensitive does it need to be? What types of measurements do we need to get out of it? Because, like, I know we had that sort of discussion, especially with like the magnetometer, where we had to make sure we got a magnetometer chip that, you know, got down into the tens of nanoteslas or less range in terms of resolution, and it took us a while to find that. Do we think that this will help advance scientific needs of lightning services? I think Jerry would be able to help answer that.
Yeah,
I know in the past that Jerry has been very clear that he'll take what he can get. Of course, you want to give him the best you can, but he's always wanted anything anyone could provide him. And in a network way, I think this could be useful. Usually the chip, as it's, when it's described, I think they usually talk about a 40 kilometer or 40 mile, I'm not sure which, kind of range for detecting major strikes just with the standard configuration.
Yeah, what's interesting is they seem to be able to, they claim anyway, they could tell you about how far away it is too.
Yeah, that's quite neat. Yes, that is good. Yeah, I see a chart down here, distance estimation table 17, where the farthest is 40 kilometers, and it goes down to storm is overhead, and not a linear scale, but there's quite a few gradations there. So I mean, it certainly looks promising. And I think it's a really good idea. I just would also really be interested in hearing what Jerry has to say about it.
Well, yeah. I mean, if we say, hey, what do you think about this? And he says, oh, that's a piece of junk, you should use this one, then we've learned a lot.
Exactly. And that's kind of what I want to hear from him. I think he'll be quite excited if we put this on here.
Well, I guess the main reason I was considering this one is, you know, we've used it before at my work, and I think we have an in to get a good price on the unit. So it'll be very cost-effective if it's going to be effective in collecting data that's useful.
I agree with that. I'm all for that. I just want to hear what Jerry has to say, since he's been the big lightning detector advocate so far.
Yeah, I have that note written down from last TeamSpeak. I set it on the pad and then didn't look at it, so I'll look at it this week.
That sounds great. Yeah, if we can provide that capability, I think that would be a very good thing to do.
I even have a little lightning simulator that's supposed to be for testing the thing.
Oh, really? What, like a little spark gap or something?
I honestly never looked real closely at it, but I was looking at this in the past for Jerry, and I don't know if I discussed this specifically, but I was looking into these things. I don't know of a lot of alternatives, except maybe an AM radio wired up with a tune between stations and a level amplitude cutoff. But I don't know whether it'll work well or not.
Well, we kind of have an AM station.
Say, did anybody notice Mike, who records our sessions and has his mic muted? He has a blitzer tongue, and he records strikes. He's 50 miles north of Detroit, and he records strikes in California and Mexico.
Okay, Dave. Now, we want to know how you know they're in California or Mexico.
They actually give you a location when you look at the Blitzer Tongue map.
There was the old Tapper lightning detector project some years back now. I think I probably have two of them that I never quite put together, but I suspect that uses an external receiver.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I put on the board was an RCA jack for an external antenna. That so you could actually use the local one and use an external antenna if you wanted to do that, and adds very little cost and lots of flexibility to it. But again, it's like I don't know how good this part is. One of the things I did find online was that people are using this board to photograph lightning strikes by taking the IRQ output and feeding it to their trigger of their camera.
Well, that's a clever idea.
So, of course, I had to add a 2-pin header for the camera, so you could use this to actually plug your camera into and trigger. But you'll have to plug it right into the device. You can't plug it into the local end because it's got to hook to the IRQ output. But I did think that was pretty interesting, how if whether it would detect the lightning quickly enough to give you an exposure.
That is interesting.
But it takes an 11-cent header and a 6-cent transistor to give you the output, so I thought it's worth it.
I found a link showing how you the FL-Digi interface for PSK Reporter. It is built right into the software, and it looks like it can do reports not only from what's being decoded, but also from logs as well.
You mean not in real time, just logs you feed into it?
That's what it looks like. I put the link in the chat window there. It says it can generate reports from three sources, the decoded text, log data, or data entered manually.
I know it is able to decode wave files. If you have historical wave files, it will handle those.
Looks like the lightning tonight is around Big Bend, Texas, and Branson, Missouri.
Okay, so now are you getting that off the net from other people's detectors, or are you detecting that directly?
Mike's detector in Detroit is part of that, and if you turn on the detector's link, it will show you who heard that lightning strike.
So the question is, did the guy in Michigan hear the lightning strike in California, or is it just this is an aggregate of all the network units that you're seeing, kind of like what we're building?
Well, it's how many units have heard a lightning strike at that time and what location. So that's how they triangulate where it is, I assume.
Oh, okay. So they can triangulate it, and then they can tell whether you heard that one or not. Well, Mike says the green lines show the station's reporting.
Blitzer Tongue's a project that's kind of interesting. It's based in Europe, I believe Germany, and they build radios that they will sell to you, but they only do them in batches, and they don't give them to everybody. They prioritized by where your QTH is.
They also, it takes a long time for them to get around to you to offer to make you one. I recently passed, well, not so recently, but in the last 9 months, passed on the opportunity to do that. They're not real generous with their data. So I don't know.
So, Mike, I don't see any green lines on this map here. All I see is colored areas depending on how many strikes they've gotten.
Push the detectors in the bottom. It strikes, detectors, and sound, and you can turn each of those on or off.
Okay, thanks. I got it. Yeah, so it looks like maybe Mike's detector, at least two people in Michigan, one either in Ontario or the UP, have been hearing the Big Bend lightning.
As I recall with the old Tapper project, the people who were involved in it were kind of amazed at the the sensitivity almost too much, given what they were expecting originally. They were hearing stuff that was way farther away than they quite knew what to do with. I don't remember who that was.
Ooh, looks like we got some activity around Rockford.
Microphone activated.
Anyway, it's pretty amazing.
It's a fun thing, but it does... An additional point for us is it displays or it illustrates that we should be thinking about visual displays of the data that's getting collected, not just lightning, but any of the stuff. If we can develop ways to get people interested in this, you don't have to be technical to run this web page.
So let's see. I'm looking at their little receiver. It looks pretty small and simple. Doesn't really tell you any much about the hardware. So, Mike, have you opened yours up to look what's inside?
They've gone through quite a few iterations of the design, I think.
Well, Mike does say it's a filter.
Is this microphone working?
Yes, it is, Mike.
Oh, good. I had to dig one up. The first one was dead. Yeah, I've got the red board. I'm in kind of a high noise area. The one in the Upper Peninsula, he's in a pretty quiet area. He records more strikes than I do. There's also one in Ferndale, which is just outside of Detroit.
Seems like the guy over near Lansing or someplace is picking up a lot.
Oh, there's one on the west side. I think the west side of the state.
Yep.
My antenna is fairly simple. It's just... It's three turns of thick LAN coax, if you remember thick LAN. And I got cross loops. I'll send a picture to the to the email list.
We like that yellow stuff?
Affirmative.
Oh, that's great stuff. And it probably has some holes drilled in the side for taps, too.
Oh, this was pristine. This was left over after the run out to the shop floor. But it is nice and double shielded. It is 75 ohm, but who cares? There are also E-field sensors with short whips. There's a whole multitude of sensors.
So it says that it connects to an amplifier. I mean, the amplifier connects to the antenna on one side and to the controller on the other. So is there another PCB that is the controller? That's the receiver, essentially?
That's correct. There's a board with a microprocessor board pasted to it. But the board you solder has got a GPS chip, which is the hardest part of the whole assembly. And then they use a LAN cable to go out to the amplifier, and I got the amplifier right at the loops. The point is it's a nice low-frequency signal and easily detectable over long distances as long as your local noise level isn't that high.
One thing I thought about, it would be awfully interesting to know about the height of the lightning.
It would also be interesting to be able to distinguish between different types of lightning, too, because there are some types of lightning that reach up into the ionosphere, like sprites and stuff, I wonder if there's a way you could distinguish between them by some kind of an electronic signature.
I think that's a question for Holman or Nathaniel.
I don't know enough about Lightning signatures to be able to tell you.
Same here. Especially, we're talking about what latitude, like mid-latitude?
Well, this map can open up to the whole world if you want.
But I think bringing one Jerry thing on board, you know, to talk about this, I think he has some idea of that. And I also believe that Lightning is a source for Whistler waves as well, and maybe some other ULF or VLF activity.
And also, just to add, Nathaniel's got the point, but the other one that is really, really well known is actually Schumann resonance, which is a lot higher frequency than what we can measure from Fluxgate. We have to have a little bit of a higher frequency radio detector, like AC detector, then we should be able to some kind of resonating structure in the ionosphere due to lightning strikes. That's really well known, and that can be observed anywhere in the world, I think, but you have to have a different magnetometer, not this type of magnetometer.
You know what frequency bands that's working in?
You're talking about Schumann resonance?
Yeah.
I believe the lowest frequency is about, there's some fixed frequency. You can Google it very easily. Like 8 is in harmonics, like 8, 16, and 30, I don't know, some kind of ELF band, which is about tens or hundreds of hertz.
Yeah, I was wondering, because I was just looking at antenna design for the ELF bands.
Oh yeah, ELF magnetometer. So ELF magnetometer can detect Schumann resonance very easily. It's actually like everywhere. It's always there. So it's pretty interesting.
Oh, yeah.
There's somebody in, it looks like Reunion Island, picking up the Texas lightning strikes.
I'm looking at the block diagram with the controller, and I don't see any hardware that we don't already have. You got a GPS, a DSP processor, an Ethernet connection. They do have an LCD display and a speaker. Well, I guess we have run over a couple minutes, but things are ground down here. So, or is everybody reading?
Well, we are at the time, so to respect that, we probably, unless something's burning, we should say 73.
Yep. Anybody have anything else?
I think that's all for me for now. I think I'm going to probably try to get a few more notes for class written before I head to bed. But I think I'm, thank you very much, everybody.
Yeah, and I'll call you later on this week or next week, Nathaniel.
It sounds good. Thanks a lot.
Okay, 73, everyone.
Okay, 73. Good evening.
73.
73.
Bye-bye.